Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this 2009 Members' Day, the Philosophical Society. I'm Tom Fisher, chairman of the society at the moment, but I've got only a brief role in these proceedings. In a minute, I'm going to hand over to Steve Chin here, who has organised the whole day, done a wonderful job in that, and he's lined up a very impressive array of speakers. So it looks like a really exciting day on state law and the individual. Just before I hand over to Steve, just as important as the speakers is the contribution we made as the audience. And I know there are some people who are here for the first time, and there are other people who have probably been here 20 times. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether this is the first time or the 20th time you've been here. Your contribution will be very welcome, and I hope you will feel moved to make that contribution during the two question and answer sessions that we have, which Marianne will be chairing a bit later in the day. If there are any non-members here who would like to become members, I've got all the details here and membership cards, and we're very happy to take your subscription and all that kind of thing in the coffee break. But I think that's all I'm going to say by way of introduction, and now I'm going to hand over to Steve.
Great, thank you very much, Tom. Can you hear me all right at the back, as they say? Tell me if I fade away, and I'll walk over to the podium and be all academic about it. Sorry about that, Marianne. Okay, I'm going to briefly introduce the day and what we'll be talking about today, and the topics and speakers that we have, while the door's being closed. And then, you always have these distractions, don't you? And then I'll be. Then what I want to do is introduce the whole topic and territory of political philosophy. Now, obviously, it's impossible to do that in 30 minutes or now 26 minutes. So what I'm going to do is concentrate in my talk on one of the key underpinning issues of political philosophy, and it's really one that I think in many ways is one of the great thought experiments in all of philosophy, and that's the whole state of nature debate. The whole issue of why the state exists at all, why we have political institutions, why we give those institutions and some individuals the right to coerce other people, including ourselves, into behaving in particular ways and not behaving in others, and why we have laws. And I'll look there. If anybody who's studied political philosophy will of course be quite familiar with a lot of that, but it's essential underpinning, I think, to a lot of the issues that are going to come up later in the day, and it really helps to understand why we call today state, law, and individual, because the big theme of today really is about the relationship between the role of the state, the making of laws, and what that means for the rights, liberties, freedoms, and indeed, of course, the obligations and duties of the individual living under the protection of the state. And of course, many of these issues are extremely pertinent and relevant in this society and world that we live in today. The philosopher Jonathan Wolfe, who, by the way, has written a wonderful book that I've only discovered since I did that reading list that was in the little flyer in the leaflet. It's Jonathan Wolfe, W-O-L-F-F, An Introduction to Political Philosophy.
Who is the author of the online political philosophy course.
Fantastic. And Marilyn's just reminded me that Jonathan is also the author of the OUDCE online political philosophy course. I recommend the book as a general introduction to political philosophy. So, I'll be doing the introduction and overview today. What we'll then be doing is going straight into Rob Judges, who will be talking about Beyond's negative and positive freedom. I'm not going to preempt anything that any of the other speakers are going to say. We'll be very careful not to do that. Then we'll have a coffee break. And then Peter Townsend will talk about Ronald Dworkin and his ideas of justice and freedom. And then James Calvert will talk about the political philosophy of the open society based on the ideas of Karl Popper. Marianne will let us then kindly agree to chair a question and debate session for us, and that's where we hope there'll be as many awkward and debilitating questions as possible for the speakers. Then we have lunch. We have Anne Long, who's going to give us a critique of a book called Against Equality of Opportunity by Matt Kavanagh, which has been a very influential book in the debate, not just in philosophy, but more broadly as well, on all the issues relating to regulating against discrimination and regulating for equality of opportunity, however that's defined. Then Alan Bailey's going to offer us some thoughts on the role of the modern state. We'll have a coffee break and a final question and debate session, and then mine's a pint, and I guess quite a few of us would agree with that. So as the two Ronnies used to say, it's a packed show today. So we need to keep to time. So I'll get on with introducing political philosophy. It's often defined, this area of philosophy is often defined as the study of the nature and justification of coercive institutions. The nature and justification of coercive institutions. Or in other words, some people say, it's all about who gets what. Who gets to tell other people what to do, and says who, on whose authority? So who gets what, who gets to tell others what to do, and says who? Of course, coercion is usually defined as the use of force or the threat of force. It doesn't necessarily have to be the application of force. The threat of force to control behaviour. In today's news, there's a lot, of course, about the Iraq inquiry and whether that should be public or conducted in private. So one might want to add the use of force or the threat of force to control behaviour or access to knowledge, perhaps, as an extension of that idea. Now, in the territory of political philosophy, these ideas and terms have to be broadly construed. So we're talking here about issues like taxation for the provision of social goods. Some libertarian philosophers that I'll touch on in a few minutes have some very powerful and strong ideas. I mean strong rather than powerful ideas about that. From taxation for the provision of social goods to how we protect people from harm to how we punish people for transgression and crime, and indeed what we class as a crime and what we class as a punishable transgression, to systems of justice and fair treatment, what constitutes justice and fair treatment, to very contemporary issues of preventing discrimination. If indeed we think discrimination is something to be prevented, and of course there are philosophers who would argue that very few forms of discrimination are legitimate things for society to try and prevent, to various questions of respect and prevention of offence and harm. I think political philosophy is such a fascinating area, partly because it's very live and it's always evolving, because it's about politics. It's not just about philosophy, it's about the application of philosophy. So I think two things that are happening now that reinforce this are ideas of power. There's a debate going on about what constitutes power. You know, traditionally, power has been looked at in very explicit terms. In extremists, If I force you to do something against your will, then I'm said to have power over you, at the most extreme. But now there's a view that power can be implicit as well. I can have power over you, even if you accept our coercive relationship, in which I win, without question, even if it never occurs to you to accept a coercive relationship, then I can have power over you in that relationship. There's even now argument that coercion can be built into epistemological systems, or systems of knowledge, how we think we know things and what we think we know, so that how we construct and evaluate knowledge is itself a source of power. And there's philosopher Miranda Fricker at Birkbeck in London, who's written a book called Epistemic Injustice, Power and the Ethics of Knowing, which is a very interesting argument about that. There's also this second very contemporary issue, which I'll call group identity, which is about cultural and religious and national identities. And in that context, we see this extension of the notion of harm into hurt. We see the idea, for example, that coming from philosophy of language, perhaps, and exemplified by political correctness, that speech itself can be a harm to someone. That if I say something that offends someone who has a particular belief system, if they decide that that's an offensive thing to them, then there is an argument that says that that can be said to constitute an actual harm or a hurt to that person, and that because it constitutes a harm, it can therefore be controlled by law, and I can actually be prevented from making that remark. And of course there's been a huge debate over the past few years about that, particularly in relation to limitation on criticism of religions. And that's reflected, I think, in the whole political correctness debate, and that's an interesting area where one area of philosophy, the philosophy of language and the idea of speech acts, the idea that to say something can be the same thing as an action, speech act theory, has been pulled into the area of public speech and even speech between individuals, and helped to support the idea that some people want to make that offence can be construed as harm, which can be construed as a hurt, and therefore is to be controlled, forbidden in some cases, and legislated against. And that's political philosophy too. And I think what that does is it illustrates the emotive power of the issues here. On the one hand, I think most of us in the room would say that we want unfettered freedom of belief. On the other, some people say that that requires protecting beliefs from criticism, because the offence caused is a harm to the believer. Others would say that the right to criticise is absolutely integral to freedom of thought and speech, and trumps anyone's right not to be offended, and that indeed there is no right not to be offended. Some of those critics would regard the idea that offence can be equated with a harm as a weak defence mechanism, not a defensible philosophical argument, and surely there is a responsibility for philosophy to try and clarify, at very least, what's at stake in that debate. Jonathan Wolfe makes the point that there's no hiding place in political philosophy, that every philosophical issue has immediate implications for the way, you know, we actually live and we actually organise our social world. So the theory that we find in political philosophy gives us a lot to say about issues like, what should the state know about us? How far can the state limit our freedoms to protect us from threats? What are the limits of my permission to dissent from the actions of my state? Not just by protesting against them, but by actually dissenting and refusing to act on them. What are the limits of tolerance in a diverse society? Should we tolerate intolerance? How far do rights to use natural resources for the benefit of the few extend? And that's an issue we see in relation to criticisms made of a lot of firms and corporations. And issues like, is cultural relativism a force for good or ill? Are all moral systems equally good and equally legitimate on their own terms? Or is there some objective moral system that it's legitimate to expect everyone to adhere to? So fundamentally, political philosophy looks at the negotiation between those institutions that have and can use power and those people, and sometimes other institutions, who are subject to it. In other words, it looks at the tension between rights and obligations, between the individual and the state, and in that context it looks at law as one of, not the only, controlling mechanism that's used. What I'll do now is focus on the underpinning question, as I said at the beginning, of the state of nature. What the state of nature is, really, I think it's fair to say, it's a huge thought experiment that says to us, what would people, what would life, what would society, if indeed there would be any, what would it be like without political authority? What would it be like without these institutions of coercion and control? What would it be like without a state, in the broadest construal of the idea of a state? In other words, what's the nature of the individuals and the conditions that we're really concerned with here? And it's an important question because philosophers have used it as the premise on which to construct arguments about the role of the state and about the legitimacy and the limits of coercion. So it's a very important theoretical issue. We'll bypass the question, if we may, of whether a state of nature ever actually existed. John Locke thought that 17th century Native Americans were actually living in one. Hobbes seemed to think that the English Civil War heralded a return to one. Rousseau thought it existed some way back in prehistory and was now lost forever for reasons that I'll look at. But let's just treat it hypothetically. Let's not worry about whether it might or might not ever have actually been the case. So in Leviathan, which is, of course, Thomas Hobbes' major work on this issue, he describes his state of nature. These are very familiar words, but they're so beautifully written. I have to read them. This is Hobbes' idea of the state of nature. There is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing of things that require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish and short. The Guardian made one of their superb misprints and substituted an I for the U in brutish a few years ago. which was about the time that the big debate on knife crime first came out. So hard to believe that it was actually an accident. So, what's Thomas Hobbes' view of people? What's his answer to the question, what are people really like and why do we need a state to coerce them? Well, of course, he seems to have a rather pessimistic view of what people are like. Now, it's important to know that Hobbes thought, indeed he lived at a time when a lot of people thought, that it's just in the nature of the stuff we're made of to always be in a state of desire. As material corporeal beings, that's the way we're built. It's just not escapable. He thought that we're never at rest, we're always striving, we're always wanting, we're always unsatisfied with what we have, we're always wanting and feeling that we need more than we've got. So therefore, for Hobbes, life just is competitive. There's no way around that. It's just in the way we are. What he does then is that he adds into the equation, into the picture, his argument about the scarcity of objects of desire. He says there can never be enough riches or power or resources to go round. And he then says that when you look at human beings, what you find is that we're all more or less roughly equal in our ability to compete, to destroy, to act violently, And when you add all those things together, that leads him to say that a war of all against all, in analytical terms, is just simply entailed by the facts of the way we are and the conditions that we're operating in. So Hobbes seems to say that our natural state is to be at war with each other. Our natural state is a battlefield, as he says at one point. Remember, this is his analysis of what life would be like without coercion, without a state. He's not proposing that this is how we ought to live. Hobbes denies that we're inherently cruel or violent. He doesn't go that far. He only says that it's in our nature to be unsatisfied, and that we act badly towards each other out of fear, out of a need to defend ourselves, because we're all in the same boat. We're all trapped by the need to strive for scarce resources, and we all have this roughly equal ability to compete with each other. So out of that, what he does is he does reason towards a set of laws, and that set of laws are such that if everyone were to obey them, then life would become, for Hobbes, secure and commodious. One of those laws, for example, is that every man ought to endeavour peace as far as he has hope of obtaining it, and when he cannot obtain it, he may use all advantages of war. That's my paraphrase of Hobbes' 17th century English. Another is that we ought each to be content with as much liberty against others as we would allow others against ourselves. That has a familiar ring, doesn't it? And they add up, Hobbes thought, to one overall presiding maxim. And that maxim also is extremely familiar from Aristotle onwards, and it is, do not that to another which thou would not have done to thyself. So a negative statement of the golden rule. So, for Hobbes, what he's done there, I think, is he's argued that in his idea of the state of nature, everyone will not act on these natural laws. It's impossible that they should, for the reasons we outlined. And he uses something like, it's not exactly the same as, but it's something like the prisoner's dilemma, to argue for the establishment of a powerful sovereign. And that's the Leviathan of the book's title. And he says the role of this sovereign is to coerce everyone to act on these laws that he's deduced from reason, so that we all know others will do so, and so that we can therefore do so ourselves to our mutual and collective benefit. I won't describe the prisoner's dilemma now, but there's a very good explanation of it in Jonathan Wolfe's book. So what we're doing now is we've got one idea there on the table of what people are really like, what the objective conditions that we find ourselves in are really like, and therefore why we need a state at all to overcome the problems that those conditions and our nature give us. There was then a rather different argument came after that from John Locke, and Locke argued, not explicitly against Hobbes, but certainly intellectually against Hobbes, that the state of nature does not necessarily entail this war of all against all. Locke thought that life could be perfectly livable and commodious without invasive, coercive government, without a Leviathan coercing us at all, with only what's come to be called now in the Lockean libertarian tradition a minimal state. And Locke argued that the job of the minimal state is really essentially to protect property rights, and that it should do as little beyond that as it can get away with, I suppose, as it needs to do. Well, how could this be? What's Locke's argument for this? In the second treatise of government, Locke argues that there are natural laws, they're there in nature, they're discoverable by reason, and that in the state of nature these natural laws define rights and they define duties that are based on mutual self-interest and mutual self-preservation. In other words, for Locke, even without a state, it's in the rational self-interest of each of us to refrain from harming each other. And this much, he says, is self-evident to human beings. It just is that way. So for Locke, the distinction, the tension between individual and collective rationality is not really an issue at all, like it is for Hobbes. It's not really an issue, because these laws are there and they're obvious to us. And his famous argument on the right to private property really shows this. What he says is that in the state of nature we can rise above the level of what he calls a savage subsistence only if By working the land and producing the crops, we come to own that land. We're given the right to own that land, meaning that we can then exclude others from it, and we can reserve its products exclusively for ourselves, because only then can we have security. Without that right, we cannot be secure. Hence the Lockean emphasis on private property ownership. So for Locke, there can be no contradiction between individual freedom on the one hand and the right of each person to take ownership of nature and turn it into their own property on the other. Now, by making this argument, Locke started a strand of thought that's come to be known as libertarianism, for the minimal role of the state and the maximum personal autonomy and freedom limited only by the natural law. And libertarians, people like Robert Nozick, nowadays would argue, some of them do argue, that even taxation is largely unwarranted. I think it's Nozick that describes taxation as forced labour. Taxation is forced labour. Nozick argues that the minimum wage is an unwarranted restriction on freedom. In this case, the freedom to buy and sell one's labour. And Nozick would say that if you have a problem with the outcomes of minimal statism, then you're perfectly free to behave differently and try and persuade others to do so as well, but you are not free to expect the state to impose your desires on others. Nozick famously also argues for a private fire brigade system. He said, just like in the old days of the Liverpool Mutual Insurance Company, his idea is that we should all fund, we should all club together, form private fire brigades. When our house catches fire, they'll come around and put it out for us rather than be taxed to provide that service. And another philosopher famously said, well, Robert, if your semi-detached neighbour's house catches fire and they aren't in this private club, then what are you going to do about it? So we have a Hobbesian justification of a strong coercive state based on the conditions of the world making us necessarily competitive. We have a Lockean rejection of that based on the rationality of recognising our mutual self-interest, leading to this tradition of libertarian minimal statism. Now, when I rehearsed this, I had a whole section on Rousseau there, but I'm not going to have time to do it. So I'll see if I can worm it back in somewhat later on the day. It's impossible in an introductory talk on political philosophy not to mention John Stuart Mill, of course, particularly for this society that we live in here today, and his ideas on freedom and liberty. Mill endorsed democracy as a system, somewhat, as Churchill later did, as the worst system of government except for all the possible alternatives. I say that because Mill recognised the shortcomings of democracy, including the threat of the tyranny of the majority. And in On Liberty, he wrote, very famously, and this is referred to as Liberty Principle, the only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilised community against his will is to prevent harm to others. His own good, physical or moral, is not a sufficient warrant. Now, I think what that does is it very succinctly negotiates, or tries to negotiate, the tension between state and individual, majority and minority, and takes a point of view about the limits of lawmaking. One question that's often asked about it nowadays is, does it justify laws like the seatbelt law, for example? Discuss might be a good undergraduate essay title. Well, you know, Mill thought that liberty only really applies under certain conditions. He thought that children, for example, should not be free to decide whether to learn to read or not, because they're not in the maturity of their faculties. He thought that barbarians, his Victorian term, should not be granted liberty because they still have progress to make and need the discipline required to make it. That sounds familiar from some debates about some sections of this society nowadays. And perhaps today some people might want to redefine what's meant by a barbarian and reapply the same principle. So, what we're going to do this morning is look at ideas of justice, freedom, and the open society. Bear in mind these ideas about the state of nature and what life would be like without as state and without coercive institutions, because they're very important underpinnings for this debate, and indeed for this afternoon's debate. Final point, Mill claims that in political philosophy, and this is another quote, considerations may be presented capable of determining the intellect either to give or withhold its assent to the doctrine. Well, he then went on to assert that this can constitute proof, and that perhaps came from his work in logic. Well, perhaps not. Perhaps he was wrong on that point. Perhaps there is no final word in this area of philosophy, as in others. It's not unique in that, of course. And indeed, perhaps in political philosophy, it would actually be politically and morally terrifying if there were a final word. Perhaps it's really only people like Pol Pot and Mao Zedong that have thought that there was such a thing as a final word. So let's see how much we can find to disagree about today. The next speaker now is Rob, and Rob's going to be talking to us about beyond positive and negative ideas of freedom. Rob. That just stops,
doesn't it?
I'm sorry about the noise. I'd just like to preface my talk with an apology. Last Wednesday, my house in Thurgood and my laptop, among other things, was stolen. On it was my handout and my carefully crafted words and arguments. It is a strange coincidence that my last assignment, when I was doing the diploma, was also on political philosophy, and that was eaten by a hard drive as well. So Marianne got a stream of consciousness then, and you might be getting a stream of consciousness now. Beyond positive and negative freedom, the central questions in political philosophy, as Steve has already outlined, are why should a person obey a state, and how property is distributed. Freedom is elemental to both questions. What is left after obedience is freedom. It's the barometer of our social interactions. Down the years, philosophers have taken very different attitudes towards freedom. As Steve has outlined, Hobbes in Leviathan thought that man without politics existed in a horrible state of nature. In this condition, their lives were ghastly, and you've already heard the well-known quote about brutish and short. He proposed it was in the interests of our survival that we give up our freedoms to an authoritarian monarch. In exchange, we got stability and peace. His work was written after the English Civil War and the execution of a king, and it was in this state of chaos that you should see the context for his words. But for Hobbes, men would be freer if they gave up their freedoms to a monarch, because they would be free from the arbitrary actions of others in the state of nature, and therefore be free from violence and be able to progress. Rousseau saw humans' natural state in a much more optimistic way, as social only cooperative. We weren't manic individuals as in Hobbes' world that needed shackling, but friendly and cooperative. There is an urge for self-improvement and progress, and there was a common good which could be understood and used for the whole of society. This common good answered his question in The Social Contract, how can I obey laws and still be free? His answer was that you could be free if you obey laws that you make yourself and that irrationally you take unto yourself. The problem he wanted to solve, in his words, to find a form of association by which each, while uniting himself with all, nevertheless obeys only himself and remains as free as before. We can do this by voluntarily doing what is in the interest of all and not our own self-interest. By using the word all, that obviously includes yourself, so the problem is solved as the interests of all coincide with your own. Now, the two philosophies that I've just outlined and their approach to freedom seem to be using freedom to mean two totally different things. One talking of obedience to an external monarch, and the other to an internal self. Now, during political philosophy, there have basically been three strands of thought about freedom. The edges blur together, but they could loosely be described as republican, you are free if you obey laws that you've made yourself. This is a kind of macro view of freedom and society. There's the liberal view, Hobbes and the libertarians, as Steve has just outlined. You're free if there's an absence of restraint. There is a private sphere in everybody's life into which the government should not interfere. This is the contract attitude towards freedom and society. And then there's the ideal strand. This is the autonomous view of freedom, where you are free, autonomous means to obey yourself from the Greek, within yourself and to obey yourself. Then Berlin came along and wrote his essay. I've read the essay. I actually went to his centenary celebrations at Wolfson this year, and I actually have the t-shirt. This is the reference in the title to positive and negative freedom. His article, Two Concepts of Liberty, was the inaugural lecture that he made as a professor of social and political theory here in Oxford in 1958. He was in fact born in Riga and fled oppression. Again, it's quite interesting the context under which this work was written. In it, he splits freedom from one concept into two, positive and negative. It's such a seminal work that a lot of people conclude that it's the last word on freedom, but philosophy moves on, and so too the meaning and practice of freedom. We need to explain the word so that it has resonances with, say, today, the people on the streets of Iran who have been demonstrating this last week. They're demanding freedom and death to dictators. But what exactly is it they are after? Is it a negative or positive freedom or something else? And in fact, does this dichotomy actually illustrate anything useful? Negative freedom, I've mentioned Hobbes already, and I think this is what Hobbes would be considering if it was classified when he wrote his article, is mainly is where a person or agent is obstructed by others from doing what he wants. This is Rousseau, as I've just mentioned as well, was thinking more of a situation where a person is under their own rational control, consciously doing what they want. In Berlin's article, Negative Freedom, answers the question, and I quote, what is the area within which the subject, the person or group of persons, is or should be left to do or be what he is able to do or be without interference by other persons? Positive freedom is involved in the answer to the question what or who is the source of control or interference that can determine someone to do or be rather than that, to do or be this rather than that. In a shorthand, basically a freedom from and a freedom to. Now, Berlin's article is a classic in political philosophy. He described beautifully how freedom had been bent and twisted to end up justifying totalitarian regimes. How a regime might come to re-educate, jail or subject its citizens in order to make them free. The idea that an external body could know what you would autonomously want to do if free. If you choose otherwise, it was because you were ill-educated, didn't know what the social good was, and should be, as it were, adjusted. It underlined all totalitarian states, and Berlin rightly condemns this distortion of the definition of freedom. However, he obscures actually what freedom is, and this talk, I hope, will illuminate an abstract and more coherent idea of freedom that we can use today when listening to the other speakers, all the elements of which are in his article. All statements about freedom contain both positive and negative elements. Here in the UK, there is a long debate about multiculturalism, looking at religion, the freedom of religion. There is in this country and in America a freedom to practice whatever religion we choose. We're free from the government telling us what to worship, but we're also free to practice whatever religion we choose. The source of control of that is myself. I decide whether to be a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, and so on. So a better description of freedom is given to us by an American, James McCullen. He gives us an equation for freedom after counting out, obviously, the physical impossibilities of jumping 80 foot in the air and all the rest of it. An agent, X, is free from Y to do Z. And this is a triadic formula, and it can then be used when considering philosophers and their statements on freedom or discussions about egalitarianism and equality to clarify exactly the nature of their freedom, the relationship between that freedom and other virtues, where freedom ranks in relation to these virtues, justice and equality and so forth. So taking Hobbes, he emphasised the Y in the equation. He advocates being made unfree by Y, where Y is the monarch. So ranking freedom below survival stability, but giving you freedom from fear and violence. Looking at Rousseau, he's considering the X, or agent, and the Y of what it is you choose to do. Berlin was right to say that freedom had been spliced historically apart and diverged into two distinct parts, but wrong in terms of helping us to understand exactly what freedom we are talking about. Freedom is one concept described by McCullen's formula, not just two distinct classes. Now, I just want to mention the preconditions before going on to talk a bit more about freedom. As we've already heard, Mill's liberty or harm principle stated that intervention to curtail the freedom of responsible adults in a civilized society can only be justified when there is a serious risk of harm to others. But what constitutes responsible harm instead is obviously up for debate. But before going on to that, Mill had a precondition, and he stated it only applied to people in the maturity of their faculties, and he also excluded backward states of society in which the race itself may be considered in its nonage. I looked that up, and it actually means age of immaturity. Hobbes talked of the state of nature. Berlin also talks of a threshold. The proposition that freedom for an Oxford don is very different from the freedom for an Egyptian peasant remains a piece of political claptrap. It is true that to offer political rights against the intervention of the state to me, who are illiterate, underfed, and diseased, is to mock their condition. So freedom only comes into the equation and discussion after a material and educational threshold is passed. I'm going to argue that Berlin's freedom from and freedom to divert us and do not capture a crucial fault line in political freedom. We are intertwined with the world, and the area of positive freedom that deals with an inner autonomous world has more to do with the mind-body problem of free will than any useful notion of freedom in a political sense. Freedom is part of the description of our relationship with the world as an individual. So let me unpack the positive freedom into three elements that Berlin runs together and which obscure what freedom is. This is based on an article by Adam Swift of Balliol College here in Oxford. First, do we have the capacity to act in a certain way? This is often called effective freedom. We have established that we need to rise above a certain material threshold before considering freedom as a useful concept. Once above that property threshold, there is still a restraint on our freedom. We all might have liked to have a Members' Day, perhaps in Antigua on the beach, with a cold beer and a steel band in the distance. Maybe I'll take a rain check on the steel band. But in a strict formal sense, there is nothing stopping us. But in a practical sense, I personally don't have the money for the ticket, and I'm not sure how many others of you do as well, but we can talk about that over coffee. Freedom cannot be exercised. A freedom that cannot be exercised cannot be a freedom. So even once past the threshold of absence, the more property you have, the freer you are. Now, Berlin would claim that freedom shouldn't be confused with the conditions needed to its exercise. Everything is what it is. Liberty is liberty, not equality, fairness or justice, or human happiness, or acquired conscience. But surely, if the pool of possibilities for an individual is enlarged, then they are freer than they are before. This is known as effective freedom. The effect on an individual, I would like to express this as a graph, actually, as a graduate, economics graduate, I'm good with graphs and money. If you put opportunities along here, freedom, and say money and property up here, I would start somewhere there, and this actually would be the state of nature down here, to which Steve was chatting, or my threshold. If you start giving people money, you start giving them opportunities, and I think it actually starts a quite steep slope. Then it would curtail as you get more and more money, and you can't remember things to spend it on. And then I just make this a supposition. I think it might actually lurch backwards once you become a celeb or whatever, and your freedom is curtailed by not being able to go out on the streets and do certain things because you're going to be mobbed. So I would say that there was that distinct relationship between freedom and property. The more affluence you have, the more possibilities you have, even if you don't actually exercise them. If I were to tax a rich person, as his marginal rate of increase in freedom is lower than that of a poorer person, I can increase the sum of freedom by redistributing the resources to someone lower down the income scale. Now, I don't want to tread on Peter's toes. He's going to be talking about Dworkin and probably maybe this a bit later. I would just like to carry on and say not only can this happen with passing on of material benefits, but it can be passed on in kind, say, in the NHS. I haven't mentioned health before, but if someone is prevented from doing something, say through asthma, is helped with free healthcare, their effective freedom is increased with every puff of their inhaler. This freedom, again, is facilitated by the transfer of property and resources. So in the words of Locke, property does not then just secure survival, it is also the security for our freedom, protecting us against dependence on the will of others and the subservience to them that this creates. A nanny state, rather than a totalitarian one, which Berlin was scared of, is justified on freedom grounds rather than those of justice or equality in redistributing income. And I'll leave Peter to carry on looking at that. But looking deeper at effective freedom, there is a hidden hand of the law behind this. Formal freedom envisages a person interfering in your life. Effective freedom considers property as also a condition. But if we tried to take the flight to Antigua and got all the way back, all the way to the check-in, what would stop us at the barrier is a security guard. But he would be enforcing the law that said that we need money to pay for a ticket in order to fly. So the actual interference is one step removed and is the law of the land, as in the title of the day. Now, the second component of the positive notion that Berlin uses in his article and is worth teasing out is that of autonomy, the Greek meaning self-rule. This element is the one he considers was distorted and was used to justify totalitarianism. And this falls into the ideal strand in political philosophy when talking about freedom. Marx considered us free when we lived according to our species' essence. Freedom, politics, and obedience are all intertwined. Freedom doesn't start where politics ends. We can't survive or flourish on our own. Berlin, and quote him again, "I am a slave to no man, but may I not be a slave to nature or my unbridled passions. This, then, is presently represented by two selves divided by a larger gap. The real self is something wider than the individual, as a social whole of which the individual is an element." This means an individual, if they can't see the wood for the trees or understand what is the general good, in Rousseau's terms, he should be coerced and forced to be free. This, then, is his monstrous impersonation at the heart of the dangerous distortion of freedom, which he thought positive liberty was. If we have given people resources, we in fact have altered their, have we in fact altered their autonomous freedom, or are they still slaves to their desires? And this inner self, though, can be altered by education. This itself has two elements. My daughter has just done her GCSEs, and then hopefully she'll go on to A-levels and be a philosophy professor. As she knows more, she expands her opportunities. She gives herself more options with more choices in life. Just as the same as with money, her opportunity pool is enlarged. The fact that she knows more treats education as a property, but it does increase her effective freedom. But education can not only be valuable in a commodity sense, but also educating it as a process is valuable. If you're taught how to analyse, balance, weigh information and knowledge, i.e. philosophy, you become more autonomously free. This independence of actual GCSEs and A-levels means that your inner self is educated, and this inner self is the part that's split between the higher rational self and your base instincts self. And it should help you overcome those instincts and passions and therefore be more autonomously free. You're in control, and so you must be freer. But what if you can't? But looking at the rational self, what actually affects it? It's things that you've been learned, it's the situations you've been in, it's the things your parents and the society you live in. These obstacles or internal barriers are implanted into our characters from the outside. Brainwashing is extreme education, and no one would claim that a brainwashed person was in fact acting freely. They would be obstructed or moulded by the state. Again, taking a drug addict, his base desire is to take drugs and his autonomy is compromised, but his higher self wants to stop. The X or agent in McCullum's equation is influenced not only by the external laws but these internal feelings as well. The idea of autonomous freedom then starts to edge into the debate over the mind-body problem of free will. We're starting to deal in whether or not the mind is supervenient on the body, whether or not emotions can be rational. And this starts to, I feel, starts to mean that the word freedom is too vague and obscure to be of any use in a political philosophy discussion. It should be talked about on another Members' Day. The third, or Republican attitude, that Berlin comes up to, mentions in his Positive Liberty, is a sort of Machiavellian version. It is evident that the state is a creation of nature and that man is by nature a political animal. Marx, and I quote, "The individual, when isolated, is not self-sufficing, and therefore he is like a part in relation to the whole. But he who is unable to live in society or has no need because he is sufficient to himself must be either a beast or a god." So freedom is a barometer within politics, not something that starts when politics ends. This is a macro version and very closely allied to the autonomous idea of freedom that I've just been discussing. There's something to be gained here in terms of living in a democracy. The dictator may give you endless freedoms from an autocratic point of view, but if you have meekly taken these edicts, somehow you've lost in freedom terms. It was this Republican stroke ideal version of freedom that got remoulded by the worlds of communism and National Socialism. Some others could know what is best for you. They were then obliged to re-educate you, put you in a gulag, and force you to be free. Today, things have moved on, but I think it's fair to say that in strict Muslim states, the mullahs will probably say that they know what is good for you. They will prescribe what will make you free under the eyes of God. If we, and we are, a progressive animal and want true fulfillment, engaging in political activity helps that fulfillment and thus will help you to achieve freedom. We are social animals. We need each other to move forward. to be happy, we have to organise how we can cooperate and keep as much freedom as possible. We should freely come together in making laws. We live under the laws we give ourselves, and this is where democracy scores. People who haven't voted in favour of Brown are free in terms of not being subjected to laws that at least they haven't participated in formulating. You may have a deterministic view of life, and what you do is determined by your makeup. But what has happened to you, and that means by making laws and participating, actually influences what happens to you yourself and is determined by you. So we have an age of free from domination of the others to live and make their rules. And this type of republican freedom helps you with your self-realisation, which I've just outlined. It gives you freedom under your own rules that you make yourself, and in terms of a simple formal freedom, and basically freedom from interference. Liberties most robust under democracy, however a benevolent a dictator is. As I've already postulated, effective freedom is the one I hope that we will discuss today, or at least be used as a baseline today, and we should carry on discussing that and maybe evolving around it into the future. The Republican aspect influences that freedom because it is through those laws that you pass that you influence effective freedom. And I refer back to the NHS and the airport check-in, that laws are behind effective freedom at one step removed. So I hope I've unpacked Berlin's two concepts of freedom with the help of McCollum, Swift and Fellows and some other classical philosophers, and given us the base to the start of the day. A workable concept of freedom that is external and effective, and it will help, and that we should actually drop or not consider to any great extent positive freedom, which I have parked quite neatly, I hope, into the mind-body problem and questions of free will. And it's coming up for coffee time, so I have to stop there.